Well, for our last paper today, Judith DeGroat will be presenting. She is currently associate professor at St. Lawrence University. She has given a number of papers in different locations, including the Dialogue as a Means of Engagement Between Cultures, Samba Diallo's Journey Towards a Post-Independent Identity at the Dakar Institute of African Studies, their first international symposium. She has also published in a recent volume the piece Women in the Paris Manufacturing Trades at the End of the Long 18th Century, Continuity and Change, which appeared in Enterprising Women. Today, her paper is entitled A Woman's Critique of Marriage, Pauline Horland's Lived Challenge to Bourgeois Domesticity. Please welcome Judith.
Michel. Ça va? Okay. Thanks. Good morning. The first half of the 19th century witnessed a continued debate over the definition and function of marriage in the wake of those during the revolutionary Napoleonic period. Rights of inheritance to divorce and custody of children to marital property were among the issues subject to legal reforms and reversals through the new century. The elevation of the bourgeois family with civic rights allocated to husbands who represented wife and children in the public sphere as a sole means to maintain social and political order did not prevent challenges to its strictures from those who defined this family structure as unjust and repressive. During the Restoration and July Monarchy, women continued the discussion about their rights in the family and as individuals, which took a range of written forms, from literature to journalism, in which reform as well as social and political revolution were offered as solutions. Some who challenged the emerging status quo experienced public rebukes and threats to their social status, although nom de plume offered some protection. Others experienced significant consequences for flouting social norms that were in the process of developing and so subject to vociferous public defense. Today I propose to examine the rationale for and consequences of living an anti-marriage stance as offered by Pauline Roland during the July Monarchy. Roland took seriously the Sensmonian theory of serial monogamy and raised the children she had with Adolphe Guiraud and Jean Essard on her own and with her name. Although criticized by some of her former colleagues for immorality, Roland also received support from like-minded friends throughout the Romantic Socialist movement. At the time, while her anti-marriage stance was not the sole object of her activism, July Monarchy authorities and the general press portrayed it as such when she was brought before the law. In the wake of her death, tributes ignored her unmarried status while presenting her as a martyred mother and so effectively eliminated her political activism. A woman who challenged the rigid boundaries between public and private life, advocated and the constructions of bourgeois society, a study of Roland, I'd like to argue, offers insight into how a woman was inspired as well as constrained by the reconstructions of normative gender roles in the first half of the 19th century. Of course, normative roles do not describe lived realities, but frame and shape how actors can respond to them. My goal here is to interrogate these narratives to explore the gendered possibilities and consequences for acknowledging sexual activity outside of marriage in this period. Roland's father was a provincial postmaster, and her mother succeeded him after his death, leaving the family on the edge of the middle class. Educated at home and then by a Sansimonian tutor, a tutor who was a Sansimonian, her mother did not at all approve of the, she didn't hire him because he was a Sansimonian, who introduced Pauline and her sister Irma to the group's ideas. Pauline moved to Paris in 1833 to follow her faith and to support herself and the three of her children who survived as a teacher and as a writer. Choosing to live by the tenets of moral openness presented by Prosperin Fontaine, Roland broke with the group when they could not accept her practice of their faith, although she remained close to many of them. First imprisoned in 1850 under the Second Republic for forming an illegal union, l'Association Fraternelle des Instituteurs, Institutrices et Professeurs Socialistes, Roland was subsequently arrested in the sweep for members of secret societies launched in the wake of 2 December 1851. Sentenced to transportation to Algeria, Roland was moved from prison to garrison to internment camp around the colony until, with her health in ruins, she was released and sent back to France, where she died of pleurisy in late 1852. Roland's early letters to her Saint-Simonian sponsors, Alguier, Saint-Hilaire, and Charles Lambert, present a young woman from the provinces, well-read in the classics and modern literature, who simultaneously sought a means of self-expression and membership in a community. Identifying herself as, quote, your daughter, she wrote to Saint-Hilaire, who she addressed as, quote, my mother. Roland poured out her disillusionment with a Christianity that seemed to be dead. In 1832, she noted the appeal of a deism, which she ascribed to Rousseau, but what truly attracted her was a, quote, to be a member of a church whose dogma I do not have to adopt wholesale, end quote. This independence, criticized as excessive individualism by Saint-Hilaire, emerged particularly with the question of female sexual expression. Roland struggled with the limitations that the doctrine of Enfantin placed on women, even as the movement itself offered the community for which she yearned. Roland's ambivalent relationship with Saint-Simonianism increased as she chose to follow the so-called law of affinities. I draw this from Naomi Andrews. By having sexual relations with men, and even after her first affair, continuing this after her first affair, which resulted in pregnancy. While this law of affinities in theory applied to both sexes who were allowed to express affinity, which meant sexual attraction, rather than to stifle themselves with bourgeois monogamy, in practice, only men could participate without stigma, and the leaders of the movement soon began to downplay this most controversial part of the doctrine. Called to account by Saint-Hilaire for pursuing a relationship with a sœur after she and Giraud had parted ways and she had her first child, Jean, with Giraud, Roland explained that the discovery of sexual pleasure had been revelatory. She wrote in a letter to Saint-Hilaire, quote, I have suffered physically and morally atrocious pains. Desire has so raged within me that I have writhed in my bed, moaning. That is my nature. Not beautiful to you, no doubt, but I do not prettify myself. Women really must tell the truth today, end quote. Truth, however, had its consequences, and she gave birth to her second child the next year. Saint-Hilaire scolded her about the consequences of unmarried motherhood, perhaps implying that the damage would be done to the movement as well as to Roland's personal reputation. Roland responded with a defense of her actions and her thought, insisting she was following the Saint-Simonian doctrine as well as challenging hypocritical social values. Quote, Mrs. Roland, no, I do not wish to be a victim for the pleasure of being one. But I also do not want to be more of a victim of the remains of Christianity than a man. Many thanks for your concern about me, but I wish you would explain more clearly what exactly it is that worries you. Excuse me. Remaining in France, as many left for the mission, many Saint-Simonians left for the mission in Egypt, Roland became increasingly disenchanted with the underlying misogyny of the Saint-Simonians and developed her own notion of feminism in the intervening years. As she struggled to raise three children on her own through writing, teaching, borrowing money from friends, and moving house frequently in the middle of the night. The ability to earn a living had become a necessity as she had her first child, Jean, in 1835, then Marie, who died at two, followed by Moïse, who I can't determine exactly what was wrong with him, but he was ill, he suffered quite a bit, and then by the baby, Irma, named after her sister. Roland took very little financial assistance from their fathers, and after a quarrel, stopped taking money from a sœur, and she refused to give their children the men's names. At the same time, she relied on the monetary and emotional support of mostly, but not exclusively, female friends to prevent starvation. By mid-century, Roland's life reflected the opposite of that of a bourgeois woman, of what a bourgeois woman was supposed to be. And yet, in her letters that describe the day-to-day challenges of living hand-to-mouth, often quite literally, as she wrote again and again to editors asking to be paid for the work she had done, Roland never expressed regret at her unmarried status and always spoke of her children with love and affection, but without any mention of their fathers. In 1847, she joined Pierre Leroux's association in the Creuse, running the school at Boussac and writing histories, encyclopedia entries, and for socialist journals. In a series of letters that she addressed to Leroux, published following the revolution of 1848 in Proudhon's Le Peuple, Roland outlined her faith in association as the principle that would lead to freedom and freedom for all. She defined society as currently existing in slavery, a state of, quote, unequal, irreligious disassociation, end quote, and called for the spread of a revolutionary dogma that held both the notion and reality of brotherhood as well as the greater plan of association. This vision of association she described as distinct from religion, which religion she defined as Catholic or Protestant, and called them organized expressions of blind faith. She contrasted this with a small C Christianity that she paired with fraternity as the goal for all humanity. This Christianity was an elaboration of the dogma presented by Jesus Christ, revealed during the 1789 revolution as liberty, equality, and fraternity. As she wrote in December 1848, quote, "We believe that humanity includes everyone equally, all individuals, male and female, who make up the human species," end quote. No mention of marriage or even of serial monogamy appeared in these letters. And early in 1849, she returned to Paris from Boussac to put these theories into action. A directive mediated statement of her views on marriage appeared that year in a form far more public than personal letters. Roland was arrested along with Jean Derouin that year for forming the Union des Associations, an effort to bring together the labor collectives that had developed following the revolution in February, including the Association des Instituteurs, Institutrices et Professeurs Socialistes. At her trial, as reported in La Gazette des Tribunaux, Roland is reported as presenting herself, quote, as an unmarried mother. She is against marriage, that by insisting on the obedience of the wife to the authority of the husband sanctifies an unacceptable inequality. Christian by morals and not by dogma, she sees Christ as a man, not a god. Her religion rests entirely in the word socialism, end quote. The opprobrium that emanates from this straightforward account is clear. The words, if not an exact quotation from Roland, certainly reflect the views that Roland had expressed in her earlier correspondence. Although the trial was about collective activity recently proclaimed illegal, the views attributed to Roland were those that portrayed her as eccentric, immoral, and perhaps dangerous, certainly not someone who was credible. Both Roland and Derouin were sentenced to 3 months in prison. The official assessment given her morality shaped Roland's destiny as much as did her continued political activities. Arrested in February 1852 for participation in the resistance to Louis-Napoleon's coup d'etat in the preceding November, she was labeled by the military commission, quote, as a fanatical and dangerous socialist, unquote. Several branches of the government agreed with this assessment. In his note forwarding an extract of Roland's interrogation to the Justice Ministry, an official from the War Ministry noted that as annoying as it was to see men only concerned with politics rather than their actual business, quote, "it is even worse to see women encouraging resistance and preaching civil war. The Roland woman is one of this sort." The attached dossier gives a fair idea of the character and principles of this woman, end quote. The biographical information at the beginning of the interrogation was supplemented by the minister sending this on with the commentary, quote, "they say she is a widow, but she protests since her principles reject the humiliating yoke of marriage. She does not accept the predominance of man over woman. In any case, she has 3 children, end quote. Her interrogator accused her of taking part in the insurrection of 3 and 4 December, and Roland explained that while she did not actively participate, she did so in her heart as a true Republican. Refusing to accept a pardon in exchange for renouncing her political views and recognizing the new government, Roland was sentenced to transportation, and she arrived in Algiers in July of 1852. The 6 months she spent in Algeria were difficult. Initially confined to a convent dedicated to saving fallen women, she was expelled for spreading her views that the nuns deemed immoral and ungodly. And my favorite quote from a letter that the head of the convent wrote was, you know, within 2 days, she had everyone refusing to go to Mass. Moved from prison camp to garrison, earning her bread as a laundress and seamstress, her health suffered. Granted a pardon arranged by George Sand, also her son Jean, who had, he was 18 by that time and become involved quite actively in Republican politics. And this pardon that was granted did not require her to swear allegiance to Napoleon III, but was based on her children's need for her. She left Algeria without the means for a cabin and spent the winter crossing on the deck of a ship, so further aggravating her health problems. She made it to Lyon before she collapsed and there died of pneumonia. And her son, Jean, had arrived just after she lost consciousness, but he was there with her. The details of her death were recounted by her friend, Jean Derain, who was living in exile in England. And in the eulogy, Derain honored her as a martyr, recognized her as a mother who had sacrificed herself for the better future of her children and others. I quote Derain, "May this glorious example awake in the breasts of every mother and every other woman the true maternal love. May they all understand that by law of solidarity, which binds together all mankind, they are mothers of every children, spiritual and moral mothers," end quote. No mention was made that Roland was a single mother, a fact certainly unimportant in the face of her loss. Another eulogy appeared in the poem Pauline Roland, written by Victor Hugo, which is part of his Châtiment. Hugo himself was in exile in Jersey then, and here too he featured Roland's motherhood prominently. The poem helped to establish Roland's legacy as in a double sense. Certainly, it brought her a wider recognition as part of Hugo's oeuvre than she might otherwise have had. Of equal significance is that Hugo framed the terms through which she would subsequently be remembered. Roland appears solely as a representation of bourgeois maternity full of compassion. I didn't have the nerve to translate Hugo, so this is in French. Elle avait trois enfants, ce qui n'empêche pas qu'elle ne se sent mère de ceux qui souffrent. This maternal role protects her from the contamination of vice and corruption that prison might have brought to a weaker being. There she taught les voleuses et les prostituées. Disait, courage, sir. Throughout her sentence, she remained true, this is still Hugo's narrative, she remained true to her nature of courage, combined with bitter anguish at the separation from her children. The final cruelty, she died before her son could reach her side to say goodbye. John was actually there, but that's a detail that makes the story less dramatic. Why had Roland to suffer imprisonment, transportation, death? Hugo tells us that she was worried about women and children, that she reached out to workers saying, quote, "La vie est dure ici, ami, ce sera bon ailleurs, avançons." That, like a lady visitor, she attended the poor, the miserable, the starving, and shared with them her love of family life. There's truth in all this, perhaps, but there's also nothing of the political meetings, of the leadership role in the teachers' union, or of the workers' association, and certainly nothing about her status as an unmarried mother. Hugo represented her as another icon of Republican motherhood, and also not as an activist on her own. She had been domesticated. So what to make of this admittedly fragmentary survey of Roland's commitment to life without marriage? Certainly she was a woman who enjoyed the company of men, physically, but also as companions with whom to debate the needed transformation of society. And her letters, that I don't have time to discuss here, she had wonderful exchanges with Leroux and Gustave Le Français and many others. Roland viewed marriage as unnecessary, even distracting from her goals of achieving equality and well-being through association for women and men in France and from around the world. As with other romantic socialists of her time, marriage represented for Roland a trap of bourgeois society. exploiting women as capital exploited labor, often in the same person. Her personal experience of unwed motherhood mirrored the lives of so many women workers, forced to support children on inadequate wages. Roland's choice of this life was not a deliberate emulation of that of her less unfortunate sisters, but due to her experience and her own assessment of the doctrines of Saint-Simonianism and the associationist doctrine of LaRue. Her extensive reading and exchanges about ideas of justice compelled her to reveal her choices without shame. Indeed, she made her unmarried status part of her politics. That this politics was used against her by the conservative officials she encountered in the public press, the court, and colonial administration is not surprising. Nor perhaps is it surprising that others on the Republican left downplayed or overlooked her defense of unmarried motherhood so that she could serve as an emblem of fragile femininity defying cowardly tyrants. Roland herself, however, expressed no regrets about her opposition to marriage. She dedicated herself to, quote, the female citizen, to the mother, to the woman. Thank you.